session of the House Workforce and Economic Development Committee to order. And we're going to be talking about current issues in workforce development this morning. And our first folks up are going to be the Oregon Tribal Gaming Alliance. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Justin Martin. I'm here today on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, where I'm also a tribal member, and the Oregon Tribal Gaming Alliance. I am the organization's manager. Unfortunately, Chairman George, who is the chair of the Tribal Gaming Alliance and the chief financial officer of the Umatilla Tribe, is staying back in Umatilla. There was a tragedy on the reservation this weekend, and he will be staying back there to deal with those issues. So our thoughts and prayers go out to the family back home in Umatilla.
Please extend our regrets.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I'd like to do today is two things. I'd like to give you a brief overview of the Oregon Tribal Gaming Alliance and really the economic impact that tribal governments and tribal gaming operations are contributing to Oregon. And then secondly, I'd like to give you some specific information about the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde and their facility, and then hopefully be able to answer any and all questions from you, Mr. Chair, and the committee. So with that, thanks again for the opportunity today. I've also submitted written testimony on behalf of Chairman George and the Oregon Tribal Gaming Alliance.
Thank you.
The Oregon Tribal Gaming Alliance has done studies over the last 3 years with Echo Northwest, an economics firm here in Oregon, looking specifically at the contributions of Indian gaming to Oregon's economy. What I'd like to do is give you a brief overview of that. Indian gaming generated just under $1.5 billion in total economic output in Oregon in 2005. That includes everything from wages to infrastructure. It directly supported over 5,000 jobs and $185 million in wages and benefits. It indirectly generated another 9,282 jobs and $282 million in income for workers in other sectors of Oregon's economy. Tribal casinos accounted for approximately 35% of every gaming dollar produced inside of Oregon in 2005. This is in comparison to the Oregon Lottery, which grew in market share from 57.6% to 58.1%, due entirely to the introduction of line games in nearly 2,000 bars and restaurants around the state. The nine Indian tribes in Oregon have invested nearly $445 million on hotels, casinos, and other tourism amenities. These investments equal about 18% of all the spending on construction of lodging, amusement, social and recreation facilities in Oregon between the years of 1992 and 2005. Indian gaming has also given millions of dollars to local communities with both civic and nonprofit organizations that support education, the arts, shelter, domestic violence, health, and well-being. In 2005 alone, over $13 million were given by the nine tribes collectively to charitable and community organizations throughout the state. The greatest fiscal impact of tribal gaming comes in the form of income taxes paid by casino employees, tribal members, and all the workers and businesses that earn money in non-direct ways because of casinos. In total, over $140 million in revenues to federal, state, and local governments in 2005 was directly attributable to the economic effects of Oregon's nine tribal casinos. I want to touch briefly on regulation. Oregon tribes joined with the state to spend more than $18 million in 2005 to regulate gaming. Tribes picked up over 70% of all the regulation costs, even though they account for only about 35% of the gaming done in Oregon. Tribes also paid the Oregon State Police entire gaming section budget of about $1.7 million. The nine tribes collectively have nearly 80 gaming commission workers who are independent of casino management, and another 110 working for the casinos in surveillance. Mr. Chair, that's a brief overview of this report, and I'd like to show the committee the report. It's the contributions of Indian gaming to Oregon's economy in 2005. We've also done this report in 2004 and 2003. I'd like to let the committee know it is posted to the Tribal Gaming Alliance Network website, which is www.otga.net. The 2005 should be up within the month. Switching gears a little bit.
Justin, if you hold on just for a minute. Representative Baum.
Just before you move on, in my country there's a lot of discussion about the relationship between the nine tribes and the federal government, the Department of the Interior, and the state being the governor and the legislature. Could you give us an outline of that relationship, particularly on governance?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Dallin. In terms of the relationship in looking at Indian gaming, under the Federal Indian Gaming Regulatory Act of 1988, our Congress essentially authorized a means for economic development within Indian country on reservations in rural economies throughout the states. It gets to a position where in certain situations it is required of the state and specifically the governor to look at the compacting process and negotiating agreements with the tribes to offer gaming in and around their reservations and communities.
Can I follow up with that?
Please.
So the state's relationship with all the gaming is by treaty really through the governor, and the governor becomes the nation-to-nation spokesman for the state of Oregon. Do I understand that correctly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dallin, it's a difficult question in the sense of I don't believe that is the case. Where I believe the case is, under the federal act, the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act of 1988, within that act, explicit directions were given to the governor of the state of Oregon, or however the state deems to work through it, to actually negotiate and enter into agreements with tribes on a government-to-government basis.
Thank you.
All right, switching gears a little bit. In terms of one of the nine tribes in Oregon, the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde own and operate Spirit Mountain Casino, which is approximately 60 miles southwest of Portland, about 35 miles west of Salem here. The Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde were originally moved to the Grand Ronde Reservation in the 1850s. 26 bands were moved to that reservation, and they existed until 1954, in which they were terminated by the federal government, essentially getting rid of all the treaty rights. And they remained terminated until the Restoration Act of 1983, in which they were restored as a tribe in name only. They were not given any land back. Originally, there were 69,000 acres in the Grand Ronde Reservation. It took another federal act, the 1988 Reservation Act, in which Grand Ronde got about 9,800 acres of contiguous timberlands back and were able to support their government through some of those timber revenues. With the onset of Indian gaming, the economic means shifted, and in 1995, Spirit Mountain Casino was opened. We currently have over 1,500 employees, about 1,550 employees, of which 10% are tribal members. We approximately have 125,000 square feet of gaming space, 2,000 machines, 40 table games, 5 restaurants within our facility. Through expansion, we now have over 250 hotel rooms, 254 to be exact, and we see about 3 million visitors approximately per year. The annual payroll for our employees at Spirit Mountain equals about $55.9 million per year. The taxes that I mentioned earlier from the overall outlook through taxes both at the federal, state, and local level equal $9.5 million per year. We spend more than $32 million annually on vendor goods and services. We're proud to say 70% of those vendors are Oregon vendors. In terms of regulations specific to Grand Ronde, the tribe pays for 6 full-time employees at a Polk County Sheriff substation, which is located right on reservation. And I'm very proud to say the Spirit Mountain Community Fund, which gives 6% of net profits back to the community throughout an 11-county service area, has just reached the $40 million mark. And those are in programs dealing with health, education, the arts, public awareness of problem gambling, and the environment. It's a very good program. We're very proud of it. In closing, in terms of Grand Ronde, where do the dollars go? Those dollars go to essential services, essential government services, health, education, housing, elder pensions, alcohol and drug programs, vocational rehabilitation programs, cultural resources, and natural resources. Yes, we've had 10 years of economic success. But in looking back, we've had to overcome the hardships of 29 years of termination. And prior to that, we've had to overcome the hardships of 150 years trying to deal with reservation life. As we move towards self-sufficiency and as we make great strides, it's important to note that we are truly lessening the benefit on the state and the federal government in being able to take care of our own. The benefits of tribal gaming and the benefits of tribal government in and around communities and non-tribal communities are providing a great deal of assistance to both tribal members and non-tribal members, folks in the immediate community. Our tribal council has a vision for the future, and it's important for them to look not just 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, or 50 years down the road, but it's important to look out for tribal members and, again, the communities in which they operate for years and generations to come. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Justin. Questions, comments, discussion from the committee? Yes, Representative Polby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Justin. Say, I was wondering, a while back I'd always heard that every tribe had the right to having one casino on their reservation, and that was sort of what I thought was, I guess, the deal with the governor. Can you elaborate on that a little bit? Is that true or not true, or what status are we in right now with the number of casinos a particular tribe can have, and whether or not they have to be on the reservation or not?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, that is correct. The policy that Oregon has and has had under the last two administrations are one casino per tribe on reservation land. That is currently the policy. Certain circumstances, folks have taken a look at that, and that's currently currently the situation. We believe that is the policy, and will continue to be the policy, potentially with an exception.
Good answer.
Follow up, what exception?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, I would say as of today, February 12th, the policy in Oregon is one casino per tribe on reservation.
Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Justin, thank you very much for being here, and congratulations on your success. And I've read your last two booklets that you were showing us, and I really congratulate you on all your good work. I think you guys have done some terrific stuff for the state. I wanted to follow up a little bit on what Representative Holvey was saying, and that is, what do you see in the future for gaming, the tribes gaming in Oregon? Is there anything that you see changing from current structure? Any new things on the horizon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, I think, one, thank you very much for your kind words about the alliance. I mean, this is really an amazing alliance in which all 9 tribes can come to the table, agree on several issues and then go out and advocate again for the well-being and what is really going on in Indian country and in those communities in which surround Indian country. It's really amazing in looking at the officers of the alliance, Gary George as the chair, who from Umatilla, Chairwoman Dee Pigsley from Siletz, our tribal chair is the secretary of that group in Grand Ronde, and Bob Garcia, the chief financial officer from Coos, Lower Umpqua, Siusla. And to have two members represented from all nine tribes is really an amazing thing. One of the reasons, in getting to your second part of your question, one of the reasons this alliance came together is what we view as really some very potential threats in the world of gaming in Oregon. And we saw that last summer through the initiative process, in which two private entity gentlemen would like to actually start a private casino within Oregon. Now, we've seen a big expansion of gaming in Oregon over the last few years, one with line games in bars and taverns around the state, but also in the wanting or the ability to have casinos and do an end run on the Constitution to allow casinos for private investors. And we see that as a real problem with out-of-state investments and out-of-state dollars coming in, looking at Oregon and saying, this is probably a good spot to try and get around the Oregon Constitution and put up a facility specifically in Wood Village. Obviously, we think that has serious implications, not just for the Indian gaming industry, but for all of gaming in Oregon, specifically the Oregon Lottery. So we've been working in a very cohesive manner in looking at the future of this. That will be on the ballot in 2008, granted that they get the signatures, but they have already qualified to be part of that initiative process in 2008. And we take that very seriously, again, because of the economic impact that we're able to have outside of essentially the urban areas throughout the rural part of the state, and we don't want to see that go away.
Yes, Representative Gerard.
Thank you. Justin, this is just something for me to understand a little bit more about the gaming industry. In Nevada, they have a statewide program that oversees gaming, and so, like, if there's a dispute that arises during the something, for example, there's been lawsuits on the slot machines that show a jackpot, but the chip says it's not. And who regulates and oversees gaming practices on the reservation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gerard, first of all, in terms of regulation, and Indian gaming has a lot of regulation. As I mentioned earlier in the testimony, the nice thing is we actually have nine independent gaming commissions. As sovereign nations, each of the nine tribes within Oregon has their own gaming commission, which are independent of the management of those facilities that actually has the oversight. Then you've got the extra layer at the federal level with the National Indian Gaming Commission. And then at the state level, in terms of the Oregon State Police's tribal gaming unit. So we do have several layers of that. Do we have one overall gaming commission that oversees all of the gaming for the state of Oregon? No, but again, I think it's a benefit. We actually have nine independent gaming commissions operating independent of facility management to actually deal with regulation and oversight. And in a lot of those situations, specifically Grand Ronde, we have we work well with all layers of regulation in terms of the county and in terms of the state in regulating our businesses.
Yes, Vice Chair Lim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Glad to see you, Justin.
Good morning.
My question is, I'd like to know, I'm sure we all are, how much is the total wages in a year, in the dollar amount? And also, you mentioned some of it, the prevention and the treatment program. I'd like to know, how much do you spend on the treatment? And in our state, we do have 1% of the lottery to spend for the treatment and prevention. And do you have any such programs in the nine Indian tribes? Do they have all? Or certain tribes have certain programs. And so I'm pretty much interested in a treatment and prevention program you might have.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, thank you very much for that question. To your first question in total wages, I opened my testimony today with the fact that Indian gaming generated just under $1.5 billion in 2005 in total economic output. And let me break down that economic output. Directly, it supported over 5,000 jobs and $185 million in wages and benefits. Then we add the indirect effects, and tribal gaming created another 9,282 jobs and $282.4 million in income for workers in other sectors of Oregon's economy. So to me, those are just amazing statistics. On your second question, I can't speak directly to...
Yes. My question is the total amount, gambling amount waged.
Okay.
I'm not interested in just the simple output and the jobs, but how much actually went into these nine tribes, the total amount of dollars. That's what I'm interested in, okay. If you have any.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, I believe I do have that number here as part of the economic impact. Direct impacts through revenues, through gaming and hospitality revenues and tribal needs supported by casinos is $674,785,000. Adding the indirects to come up with that total economic output number is $799 million additional dollars. That gets us to about $1.474 billion. So those are the specific numbers, and I'd love to share that in this report, which you will have in the upcoming month. Your second question, Representative Lim, deals with treatment programs, and I can speak specifically to Grand Ronde and the treatment program. Part of the 6% Spirit Mountain Community Fund is dedicated to problem gambling. We've worked over the years with the Oregon Gambling Addiction Treatment Foundation, in which I'm also proud to be a member of. I don't have specific numbers, but I can get those for you today in terms of what all the tribes have given with respect to problem gambling, and I will specifically give you numbers in which Grand Ronde has given to problem gambling over the past 10 years since the inception of the community fund.
Okay, and follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
And yes, I will be deeply interested how much you have and that the amount, what percentage are compared to the revenue you have. And also specific, what programs do you have concerning the prevention and also the treatment and some history of it? And I'm not sure that you mentioned $674 million. Is that the total revenue I'm talking about? I'm not sure whether I expressed correctly. Total wages, total amount of revenue received. Not expenses. I'm talking about the whole pot, how much they got in.
Grocery.
You're talking about grocery.
Thank you very much. Yes.
Just from gambling.
Yes.
Quite a bit more, wouldn't it?
Yes, it should be.
I think
you do. Is it the total wager or
wager? Yeah. How much is gambled, bet?
Exactly.
Won, lost, on the table,
or
in the pot.
Or however.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for helping.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, what I have here are totals of economic output, both direct and indirect. I do have totals for wages and benefits. I don't believe, unless I'll go through this report and certainly share that with you, absolute gross revenue generated by tribes. I know it's in here. I don't have it sitting in front of me today.
Could I assist with that just for a second? When we get a report about the activity of the lottery, among the things that we get are the total amount of dollars that are waged, that are bet in the lottery, the total amount of the prizes that are paid, and then an accounting of the balance for all of these other things. What I think you've given us is all the other things. A much larger number, of course, is the total amount that's bet and then the prizes that are paid out.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, I believe I've found it here on page 28, and excuse my non-economic mind, but revenues and expenditures, revenues and selected expenditures by tribal casinos in Oregon in 2005. Revenues, gaming revenues, $459,688,000. Food and beverage, $49 million. Hotels and RV parks, $21 million. Gift shops, recreation, another $16 million. For a total revenues in 2005 of $546 million.
Yes.
So the actual gaming dollars would be $459 million.
Yeah. And if I may, Mr. Chair, I think what you're giving us is the net.
Is the net.
Okay. What we're talking about is the total amount that went on the table, and that would be a much, much larger number. You're probably dealing with, I'm guessing, 6 or 7% of the gross revenues, because most of the revenues will be paid out in prizes.
I think we're trying to compare apples and oranges. As Representative Lem and I, excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you.
Please.
last year, Representative Lem and myself were very interested in total dollars played, which you can do with the lottery. But when you're sitting at a table and the House is taking a share, it's impossible to come up with the figure that we want or that we got last time.
No, we can't.
We drove that discussion with the notion of there's this much money in the lottery, how much money is for cure and prevention, and tried to establish a ratio. I think we're asking Justin to give us figures that I think are impossible.
That may be. I think he can tell us that.
No, he's frantically searching those pages, and I don't.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Dallum, you know, I'm just giving it a shot here with my report. We'll certainly work towards that, though. And again, we do have a good relationship with Eco Northwest, and I know they've done several other studies, obviously throughout Oregon, and we can work to get you guys whatever information you do need.
Mr. Chair, and if I could give an example, if when I go to Nevada, I buy a roll of nickels. And I put them in the nickel slot machine, and eventually I've spent my $2. but in the meantime, I may have won $20 and actually bet $22. And I think that's perhaps the issue that Representative Dallum is talking about. And of course, who can tell at that point? That would be a good day, of course. that took me that long to spend the $2.
Yes, Vice Chair Lynn, please.
Thank
you're
you very
a big
much.
Spender, aren't you?
Exactly, that's what I'm talking about. Total wager, gross incomes I'm talking about. Okay. And we have heard a lot concerning the law center in coming years in Washington State, about 16 miles from the Columbia River. And what I'm reading in the newspaper some time ago, it will be one of the second largest in the nation, entertainment center. And could you give us your opinions in case that is operational, and many Oregonians might be going over there, and then you are facing strong competition. What do you expect out of this competition from Washington State, which I'm concerned also?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, on behalf of Grand Ron, I can speak specifically to that. There are currently in the works a facility being talked about. It's currently at the federal level right now in La Center. It is the Cowlitz Tribe. They are being funded by the Mohegan Tribe back east, who owns and operates one of the two largest casinos in the world. There are concerns there. There are cultural concerns. Is this really the right place for this facility to be located in terms of their Aboriginal territory? As a restored tribe, Cowlitz has some other options under the federal law that they can look into. In terms of economics, is there an economic concern from Grand Ron's point of view? Absolutely. There should also be an economic concern from the state of Oregon, and in terms of what that means to the Oregon Lottery, in terms of what that means to infrastructure, in terms of what that means to people traveling out of state to go to that facility, and what kind of impacts that will essentially have on the gaming industry here in Oregon. And as I noted before, about 35% is tribal gaming, and about 58% is Oregon Lottery. And I think that will have significant impacts upon this state.
Not seeing any further questions or comments, Justin, thank you very, very much. Appreciate your getting out early this morning and presenting us with all the economic impact of the nine tribal gaming facilities here in the state. Certainly a very, very dramatic impact on our state's economy. And I just comment that I took a tour of the Grand Ron facility once and was most impressed with the security measures and whatnot that are in place there. So good job.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Thank you. Next, we're going to have up the community colleges, and I believe we have representatives from Lynn Benton, Chemeketa, and Blue Mountain. If you'd come up as a panel, do we have enough room if we come up as a total panel? If we don't, we can do a couple of panels. Good morning.
Morning.
Welcome. Welcome before our committee here. I'll let the three of you decide who's going to go first. And before you begin, if you would individually introduce yourselves preceding your testimony. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rick Clancy. I'm the Agricultural Sciences Department Chair at Lynn Benton Community College. And first of all, I'd just like to thank you for this opportunity to speak before you this morning. Contributions that we make as a college trying to identify and target agricultural science students to come into our institution begins prior to, I guess, them even coming in. And many times we don't get these students. We have a program at our high school called College Now where we offer college credit to students for taking classes at the high school level. We offer five classes that we articulate for a total of 16 credits. The charge for that this year is going to be $25. If they were to come to our institution and take those same five classes, it would take $1,040 to buy that. Currently, we have 20 to 25 high schools from around the state that participate in that program, and that number has been on the increase over the past few years. And they come from across the state, not just Lynn and Benton counties. Other activities supported by our Lynn Benton Community College staff that we're very, very proud of. We conduct the state 4-H Livestock Judging Contest that brings teams from around the state of Oregon to the Lynn County Fairgrounds in the state of July. And anywhere from 125 to 150 young people participate with hopes of winning that contest and going on to the national contest in Louisville, Kentucky in November. During the spring in April or May, there's a state skills contest that is in conjunction with Oregon State University, multiple different types of contests that are involved during that time where young people do a variety of different contests. On our campus, we do the agricultural mechanics contest, which is usually about 100 to 125 students. And in conjunction with Oregon State, we run the spring contest there for the livestock judging, which impacts about 250 to 300 students on a given year, trying to hone skills in livestock evaluation. And they also have a component of oral reasons, which they give basically a little short synopsis of why they selected the animals that they did. Again, critical thinking skills being developed that can be used on any job, job setting. In August, we also coordinate with Oregon State University to put on the state FFA livestock contest, which is very, very similar to the 4-H contest. Again, another 200 to 300 students involved on any given year. So that's kind of some things that we do even before students are at the college level and something that we're very, very proud of. Once students decide to enroll at Lynn Benton Community College, they have many unique opportunities that they can take advantage of. The first thing is a degree partnership program with Oregon State University that allows students to take classes at both institutions, becoming full-time at one or part-time at the other or vice versa, or they can be full-time at Lynn Benton while still taking advantage of some situations such as living and meals and medical care over there at Oregon State, with the intention of transitioning over in 2 years or maybe 3 years to Oregon State University, try to provide a seamless transition. The agricultural program was one of three pilot programs that started several years ago, along with the business program and the engineering program. So those are some things that we've done in partnership with Oregon State University. As far as our own programs, we have a horse management program that's regional in nature, very, very unique in terms of its type and kind. We are very fortunate to have made available to our students our own facility about 4 or 5 years ago, which is about a mile from campus. We have our own breeding program. There's a training program that goes through to give students hands-on type of experience in all different phases of equine science. It's a very, very unique program in the Northwest. A co-curricular activity that students can get involved with is an equestrian team, a riding competition. They're the only community college in the Northwest that has such a team. They compete around the Northwest, have won many awards in terms of competing against universities that have maybe more funding and better facilities and whatnot, but they've been very, very fortunate in terms of their representation of our school. We currently have one young man who has qualified for the Nationals this spring that will be held in Pennsylvania, so again, very, very proud of that fact as well. We are the only junior college in the Northwest to field a team. Moving on to, say, animal science majors, here we have a very unique opportunity. We don't have a school farm per se, as I believe Blue Mountain does, but we use the livestock producers in our area as basically a lab. If we're going to go out and teach students different management techniques, different things like that that they'll use in a job that they might get down the road, or if they're going back to their own family farm, we have a very unique relationship with producers that have been cultivated for many, many years. I'm a product of the program myself back in the early 80s, and some of those same producers that I went to as a student, I still take my students to. That's the length of time and the relationship that we've had with these people, and the support is just tremendous. Another co-curricular activity that we have for the more livestock-oriented kids versus the equine end is the livestock judging team, which is a very big component of our program. We have had young people, again, we've had people win national contests on an individual basis. We have had people go on in the industry and as a result of a partial result of the skills that they've gained, again, critical thinking and public speaking ability gained through this activity. Of note, when I was coach back in the early 90s to mid-90s, many times we were in Culver, Oregon at Senator Ben Westman's ranch, and are very fortunate to have his support as well. Our general agriculture majors, as we go through, are now working on an organic garden that we have at our school in the back part of campus. They have been raising produce for the last two summers and selling it through our culinary arts program at school, so another relationship cultivated in that respect, which is very unique in as well. The horticulture students, again, we have an on-campus greenhouse that is up to date and highly technologically advanced. Again, it gives those horticulture students, again, hands-on experience, practical skills that can be gained to take on into the workplace. All these majors that I've previously talked about, if they so chose, could go into the agricultural education field or agricultural sciences instructors at the high school level. Currently, I'm very proud to say that we have 20% of the high school agricultural instructors in the state have passed through the doors at Lynn Benton Community College, so that's a pretty significant number. All these programs couldn't exist without the community support that I've mentioned previously. We have advisory committee members, seven, I believe, in the animal technology field, and I believe the same number on our agriculture horticulture committee. Most all of those people are either in the education field or are people that are basically in the field of study that we've talked about in animal science, equine science, or agriculture and horticulture. They kind of keep us grounded in terms of what's needed in terms of job skills. Any changes in our curriculum that need to be presented and addressed, we try to go ahead and lean on their support. Another aspect that I haven't mentioned, many of our programs, such as horticulture and equine science, have an internship or what we call a CWE or cooperative work experience component, where they have to go out in the field and get their hands dirty. they have to go out and X amount of credits in terms of fulfilling their degree requirement. They have to go out and work in the field and find out what it's exactly like if they don't have that experience. In terms of our staff, all of our full-time and part-time staff are also involved in the agricultural industry, which I think gives some credence and merit to when we are in the classroom, speaking from not just book learning, but hands-on experience. Like I say, all of our faculty are involved in some way, shape, or form in the field that we study. In closing, just maybe a few success stories, and I'm sure that we don't want to dwell on this, but there's a couple graduates that I think have made significant impact in some different roles. The Deputy Director of Agriculture, Lisa Sharpelow Hansen, is a graduate. A young man by the name of Brad Gore is a manager of a company called VSI, Veterinary Services Incorporated, a company that is up and down the West Coast. And I was talking with him just last week, and said they did a little over $20 million in terms of gross sales last year. So not a small company in any way, shape, or form. The information technology specialist, Loyal Burns, is also a graduate. And Katie Dunlap, which is a former student as well, is on the faculty at Texas A&M University, the veterinary medical staff. And of note, these four individuals were all members of livestock judging teams, just to take note of the importance that program has and the impact that it has on some of these young people. So, again, thanks again for the opportunity, Mr. Chairman, the committee. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have at this time.
Thank you very much, Rick. Unless the committee has burning questions here, maybe we'll wait and ask questions of the entire panel.
Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Preston Wynn, and I'm representing Blue Mountain Community College located in Pendleton, Oregon. It was a wonderful drive from there yesterday, and I always enjoy coming up the gorge and being able to come to Salem and talk about the opportunities in rural eastern Oregon. Blue Mountain Community College is a college that services an area of 18,000 square miles, so we have a large charge to be able to serve students in our area. One of the unique things that we do then in that respect is to serve six counties in northeastern Oregon. That's quite a charge for an institution to be able to serve that many students in that large of an area. But we try to be able to serve that area with diversity and with quality. And we allow the expenditures that are given to us, the funds that are given to us from the state legislature, and try to use those in the most appropriate way to provide services for the students that come to us. One of the unique things that we have at Blue Mountain Community College in our agriculture department is a 100-acre farm. And this is an operating farm that the students have opportunity to work with various crops and livestock, including dryland crops as well as irrigated crops, including circle irrigation and wheel lines, micro drip, flood, hand line, and big gun irrigation. So we are not just a dry land type of a facility. Included in that farm also, we have an equine science program where we deal with horses. We have a livestock component which deals specifically with the beef industry. And the opportunity for students, they have an opportunity to fatten out livestock, and then that is sold through the ag marketing classes, so they see both the production side and the marketing side. We're unique in that respect, and our lab is something that we, as well as our students, are very proud of. Certainly, vocational programs in the past, and they continue to be expensive programs, and they are targets for cuts in education. And yet, my experience as a 28-year veteran of professional, technical, or vocational education tells me that we have had the opportunity and continue to have the opportunity to provide occupational skills for students who can go out and then become employed and pay taxes in this state. So I'm proud to say I'm a vocational educator and have had opportunity to impact students' lives and through those students, then the lives of others in the state of Oregon. I'm also proud to say that I'm a native Oregonian. My great-grandfather started our farm in 1875. If you talk about, I think, workforce development and economic development, I can speak to several years of that on our farm, and certainly I'm pleased for that. I think agriculture has that unique opportunity to be a continuum for the state of Oregon. We believe in partnerships much like Lynn Denton Community College does, and our partnerships go with the FFA organization. When I was involved in it, it was Future Farmers of America. Today it's FFA, still Future Farmers to me. And we have hosted leadership skills contests. Just last Thursday, we hosted a leadership skills contest on our campus, which included 160 high school students. In April, we'll host the shop skills contest, 140 students. We'll be going to the state FFA convention to be able to work with individuals in the FFA, about 2,500 of them at Oregon State University during spring vacation in March. We also go to the Ag Teacher Summer Conference to interact with 130 professional educators, just like ourselves, but on the high school level. We also believe that other partnerships are just as important, and we are involved with the United States Department of Agriculture as well as Oregon State University through several different venues. One of those is through investigation and experimentation with organic farming, and we currently have a trial going on our 100-acre farm in cooperation with Oregon State University Experiment Station to provide data for agriculturalists to investigate organic production in Oregon. Biodiesel is something I'm certain that many of you have heard about, and it's one of those things that seems to be on the forefront of many people's minds today. We as an institution, and specifically as the Agriculture Department, have a test facility at our farm, and we have a crusher which our students are having opportunity to be able to operate and then take the oil and change that into biodiesel. And we've actually crushed some seed from the Willamette Valley. We had some individuals that contacted us and said, can you take our mustard seed and crush it for us? We're not interested in the oil, but what we are interested in is the meal. And will you ship the meal back to us so we can use that as an organic pest control on our land? And so we said, yes, we'd be happy to do that. And we're interested to see what the results from that experiment will be. We'll find out in the next year how that happens. Along with mustard, we have canola and rapeseed and camelina and sunflowers and safflower, and I could go on with others, but those are all oilseed crops that our students have opportunity to not only see but then to crush and identify which are the best from an oil standpoint and also from a biodiesel standpoint. We're very proud to be able to have that partnership. Another partnership that we have, as you listened previously, was we have an agreement with the tribes, with the Confederated Tribes of Umatilla Indian Reservation, and we are working diligently with them to establish a rural equine center, which we can use as an instructional facility, but they can use also as an economic driver in conjunction with their casino and other things that they are doing on their land. We also tie in with the community. We each year have our students in leadership development class work with students in the K-12 system, and they usually host about 2,500 students in a pumpkin patch tour and give them an opportunity to see what agriculture is about right there on our 100-acre farm. We have a greenhouse where students produce plants and then sell them at the farmers market in Pendleton, Oregon. That's an economic developer, certainly for our community. And we deal with service organizations as well. Our staff, there are four of us in our department. Dale Wendt is our ag business instructor. I teach crops and ag mechanics. John Farquharson is our adult farm business manager and technology instructor. And our adult farm business management component has him go out to individual farms and ranches and equip current agriculturalists with better management skills so that they can, in turn, increase economic development in the state. We have production ag degrees as well as ag business degrees and transfer degrees so students can go on to a four-year university if they so choose. But after 2 years, they could complete their education and go into the workforce. Certainly, it is less expensive to go to a community college than it is a four-year university, and that's one of the things that's a selling point for our programs. Interestingly enough, we charge less for students to come to our facility, but our program is more expensive than a lecture-type facility. So there's an interesting dichotomy there. Rick talked about some successes. I also would like to at least point out a couple of successes from students. We had a student, Kevin Bruneau. He now owns a business, Kevin's Brookside Nursery. He purchased this business 7 years ago. It had one greenhouse and had a workforce of only two individuals in that business when he purchased it. He now has eight greenhouses, 40 acres of nursery stock, and approximately 14 employees. So he's taken the information that he learned at Blue Mountain Community College and has turned that into a pretty good success. And that's located in Milton Freewater, Oregon. So he didn't go out of state. He stayed local. We have others. We have another gentleman by the name of Chris Zeta, who determined that he wanted to work for an international corporation called Syngenta, and they are a huge corporation. And he got a job after completing his program at Blue Mountain Community College. Our program has been recognized not just locally, but it's been recognized nationally. And the national recognition comes from the 11 Western states. We were the outstanding ag program, post-secondary ag program, 3 years ago in the 11 Western states. And that includes community colleges as well as four-year institutions. So we're very proud of that. We work with National Science Foundation as well as AgriKnowledge. Certainly the diesel tech program that we're bringing back to our school through the generosity of the federal government of $1.2 million grant, we're going to be bringing that back in, and we'll work closely with them because there's certainly diesel needs in agriculture as well. So that's not our program, but we will work closely with that. I also would like to thank you for your support in the past. Thank you for having us here today, and would ask for your continued support of agricultural education in the state of Oregon, because as agriculture has gone, at least in the past, in the state of Oregon, so has the economy of Oregon gone. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee.
Thank you, Preston. Representative Dolan.
Mr. Preston, I was out to your campus and the experimental station. I was particularly impressed with a figure with the irrigation systems, the Big Gun Drip and others. If we could get a similar amount of water from the Columbia River as Washington gets, we could add tremendous volumes of high value, very productive land to our land facility. Do you have any idea how much that is and what kind of water resource we'd need out of the Columbia?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dellum, thank you for your question. Current data indicates that the amount of water that Oregon takes from the Columbia River ranges anywhere from 0.5% to 1.5% of the total volume flow for the Columbia River. This is a pretty small amount in relationship to what could be taken, in my view. Indications from local sources in Hermiston and others would indicate that if we were able to take an additional 0.5% of the flow from the Columbia River, we could meet most, if not all, of the needs in the next 20 years for agricultural production in that area.
Any notion how much land we could add to the agricultural base for other than pasture land and that sort of thing? It seems to me it was phenomenal.
I can't speak directly to the exact number of acres. However, I do know that when I did my student teaching in Hermiston at the high school level in 1979, there was very little land out in that area that was irrigated. And now there are thousands of acres. My guess would be that we could probably increase agricultural production in a neighborhood of 40,000 to 50,000 additional acres. That's the best guess that I could give you at this point. I also know that that we're using water more wisely. In 1979, in Hermiston, when they were producing watermelons by flood irrigation, they were able to raise 10 tons per acre, and today they've increased that production to 30 to 50 tons per acre using one-third as much water because they've changed from flood irrigation to drip irrigation. So agriculturalists are being very responsible with the use of that water, and And some of the water issues that you will be asked to deal with in the upcoming months, I think, are critical to economic development in our area. Certainly, the study that is going to be done on taking Columbia River water and putting it behind a dam in Umatilla County would be a very large benefit. And then recharging the aquifers in the Hermiston area so that it can be used at the times when we need it and would be extremely beneficial. I don't know whether that answers your question, Representative.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Thank you.
Preston, just for my own clarification here, the 1.5 to 1.5% that you mentioned, the water take out of the Columbia, is that just for agriculture or is that total usage?
My understanding is that that's for agricultural use. I may be incorrect, Chair, but that is my understanding.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
I think, Mr. Chair, that we should point out that I think Washington takes three times what we do, or four times?
Three to four times as much as what Oregon does.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Anderson. I'm the director of the Department of Natural Resources at Chemeketa Community College. I also appreciate the opportunity to join this panel this morning to enlighten you a little bit of some of the agriculture programs that Chemeketa has ongoing in the workforce area. I think you'll appreciate when I complete my presentation that there's a lot of complementarity that goes on among the community colleges in the state of Oregon, and the programs that I will discuss with you this morning are pretty specific to the Willamette Valley and our service district of Marion Polk and Yamhill counties, and really don't touch much duplication to the two presentations that we've heard before. I also want to emphasize to you that Chemeketa's agricultural programs that we conduct are always industry-driven and based. And how do we get that information? It's primarily through ongoing advisory committees in key specific areas. But we are also specifically committed to stay in contact with industry in a variety of ways so that we are always knowledgeable about the training needs because we always want our training to be relevant. The first program that I would like to give you some information on is Chemeketa's Vineyard Management Winemaking Program and the Northwest Viticulture Center. This is a unique program in the state of Oregon, and it's basically a one-of-a-kind in terms of its completeness. This program came about as an industry request by the wine grape industry in Oregon because they came to Chemeketa in 1998 and said, "We have a shortage of trained workforce. We need some more training for supply this workforce." They were having to send employees or potential employees to California or do extension training or other areas. And upon some investigation and doing some pilot courses, Chemeketa then was able to have the State Board of Education approve the Vineyard Management Winemaking Program that actually launched in fall term of 1999. So we're in our eighth year of delivering that education. We soon realized that without some kind of a physical facility, it was going to be difficult for long-term viability of this program, and so we started planning a physical facility to house the program, and in September of 2003, we dedicated the Northwest Viticulture Center, which is located out in West Salem off of Highway 22. In that facility, we have classrooms, we have a 1,400-square-foot teaching winery, and an 8-acre teaching vineyard. And so students actually are able to get training in either vineyard management or winemaking, and we offer a degree in each of those areas with a hands-on approach. They are approached with a practical aspect. We currently have between 60 and 65 students who are pursuing one of those two degrees somewhere in their stages of doing that. Last academic year, we had 600-plus enrollments. That means students occupying seats. Our students currently are a combination of a variety of backgrounds. About half of them are either in the wine grape industry in some fashion now or are aspiring to be. We also have vineyard winery owners that are actually coming in and taking a block of courses because either they've just gotten in the business and they don't have that background, or they just want to have some updated information in a specific area. We also have students who are coming to us not only from the state of Oregon, but from other states throughout the United States and even some international locations. I would refer back to the success of the program is primarily dependent upon the strong advisory committee that we have. We've had an advisory committee appointed prior to the time that the program was actually developed. That program advisory committee has stayed active in the ongoings of the program. They meet three times a year and keep us constantly informed of what the needs are out there and are a sounding board for some of our proposals. Our latest advance in this vineyard management winemaking program is we are in the stages of developing a wine marketing degree to go along with the vineyard management and winemaking degrees. Upon researching this area some, we found that there's very little education in specifics of wine marketing. Either in Oregon, the Pacific Northwest, or even throughout the U.S., there's a very short amount of that ongoing. So we are in the final stages of developing that degree, and we hope it'll go before the State Board of Education next month or in April, and we're looking forward to having that as a combination with our other two degrees. The second program I want to touch briefly on is one that Preston mentioned, and that's our agribusiness management program. These kinds of programs used to be prevalent throughout Oregon and Washington and the Northwest, but I believe Blue Mountain and Chemeketa are the ones that are remaining in terms of full-blown programs. We actually serve most of Western Oregon in conducting this program. In our case, it's a non-credit program that focuses on record keeping and analysis of those records, and then using the results of the analysis for making financial and management decisions. And it's geared towards the active farmer. You have to be a full-time farmer or a manager of a farm that has access to the financial records in order to be admitted into the program. And that is because the instructors actually use their own records for the teaching purposes. This program is in its 37th year. It really is as old as Chemeketa Community College is. And so I think that speaks to what it's done for the agriculture community and for its viability. The instructors, there are two full-time instructors that serve somewhere between 65 and 75 farm businesses each year. Last year we had 67 farms. This year we're up to 74. They do classroom instruction during the off period in terms of agricultural activity from mid-November to April. And then they are also committed to on-the-farm consultations with the farmer in the office on a confidential basis. And so it's been quite an effective program. Last year, our 67 farms represented somewhere around $50 million of gross sales and had about 560 employees. So we think that's really an important program. And that program also ties over into vineyard management winemaking because we do have a wine industry business management course that's required of those students as well. The other area that I wanted to touch on was pesticide training. If you handle a pesticide or apply a pesticide, you're required to be licensed by the Oregon Department of Agriculture. We've become a center for providing training to help people become licensed, and then also doing recertification classes so that they can gain their license, renew their license without having to go back and take the exam. And we offer training in about eight different categories that individuals would have to do testing in order to achieve that license. And you have to understand that if we do recertification courses, that those courses are submitted to the Oregon Department of Agriculture ahead of time and granted the recertification credit, and then we have a sign-up list that the individual will actually sign. The other area that I wanted to touch on was some of our training, our workforce training in Spanish. We do have a limited number of courses in Spanish. You have to appreciate the fact that many of our vineyard workers and our nursery workers are Spanish speakers. Although I think it's widely acknowledged that for them to get ahead, and they do need to at some point acquire English-speaking skills. But when it comes to technical matters, we've found that it's very effective to do some of those trainings in Spanish. And we did develop some of those in the viticulture area, and again, this was industry-driven. We appointed an industry task force, asked them to identify the areas that they might like training in, and then got their input on what should be included in that, and have gone on with that perspective. Employers primarily send their employees to these trainings. They're non-credit six-hour workshops on Saturdays, normally speaking, and that has been very effective, and our vineyard employers, especially the vineyard management companies who hire large numbers of those types of employees, have been very appreciative of that service. We also have another one we call Ag Leadership Development, which is focuses around the communication skills and teaching individuals to be able to work with other workers and supervise individuals. And that has been delivered for a number of years now, and many of those deliveries have been on a worksite basis where we actually contract with the nursery or the vineyard to actually go out to their worksite and do the training on the worksite. We are also developing one in farm equipment maintenance, and now also are looking into the and doing the research for a math in agriculture to be delivered in Spanish. One of the real shortcomings of a Spanish speaker in working in the pesticide area or working other areas is their math skills, and if we can improve their math skills, we'll make them a better employee and also give their chances for advancing in the industry. A final comment is our connection to high school students. We've heard Rick and Preston talk about that, and that's very important for bringing students into agriculture. We have quarterly meetings with our high school instructors that are in the natural resources ag areas. And now, a couple of years ago, we did what we called a horticulture industry symposium, where we brought together members of the industry to make presentations on what jobs were out there and what skills were required for those jobs, and had them with the agriculture instructors as well. We are also in the final stages of proposing a horticulture degree, and one of the main features of that degree will be seamless transition, emphasizing the college credit now that Rick mentioned in the high school that would transfer to Chemeketa, and then have also having articulation agreements with Oregon State so that they hopefully would be able to move along the chain with very little problems along the way. And to go back to viticulture, we do have an articulation agreement with Oregon State at the Horticulture Department for the vineyard management degree. There is a block of credits that will transfer down there for that horticulture degree. My final comment is, in your packet you will see this Agricultural Skills and Career Ladders project. This is a project that was done with a grant by Chemeketa, and I think Kevin Boyle, who testified before your committee on Friday, may have referenced this or referenced the fact that we are involved in something along this line. But basically, this identifies the jobs that are out there in the horticulture and viticulture areas, what the skills are for those jobs, and what some of the gaps might be in terms of where training needs to be conducted. So, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, once again, thank you for this opportunity, and I also would be happy to answer questions.
Well, thank you very, very much, Representative Dahlem.
Could you talk quite a bit about an applicator's license? And I heard 6 hours to be qualified to apply various pesticides. Did I hear that correctly, or is that more than 6 hours? Start to finish, somebody comes to you, tabula versa, and you're going to qualify them to apply pesticides. How long will that take?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dahlem, we are not actually qualifying them. You have to understand that they are actually tested through the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And we are just providing a service of training for information around which those tests will occur. And those trainings vary anywhere from 6 hours up to 12, 14 hours, depending on the area.
Thank you very much.
Representative Giroux.
Oh, thank you, Chairman. I just want you to know that I've spent time on Chemeketa and Lynn Benton Community Colleges, and my hat's off to you. I think those are really fine facilities. I'm sure Blue Mountain is equally as fine. I happen to be one of those people that thinks that we've dramatically underfunded community colleges because the cost-benefit analysis is extremely high for both community colleges and higher education. So here's a softball question for any of you. Since you're before this committee, what can we do for you?
You got a couple hours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Giroux. I think that the best thing that you can do for us is to be able to be, so to speak, cheerleaders for professional, technical, or agricultural education to your peers when it comes to continuing support, not just verbally, but also financially, in community colleges and four-year institutions. As a part of that, at least I would propose, and I believe these two would support this also, that some of the funds that would actually go to the community colleges and to the four-year institutions would be targeted funds specifically for agricultural education or professional technical education, because oftentimes we're targets because we're the most expensive programs. When you would then target those funds, they would have to be used specifically for those programs, which would leave us as at least a smaller target for cuts. That would be my at least initial response, sir.
Chair Witt.
Yes, please.
I have a question for Chair Witt.
Now I'm on the hot seat.
With the Chancellor of Higher Ed, can we do what they ask? I mean, can we? It used to be we couldn't. That the Chancellor had an oversight, and how he spent the money was kind of up to him, and that we couldn't earmark money to certain programs. Is it still that way? Do you know?
Well, harking back to my lobbyist days, Representative Giroux, when you don't have the answer, you just say, "I'm going to get back to you."
Okay,
I'll have to look into that.
Yeah, I'm not sure we can legally do that.
Well,
as it stands right now, that doesn't mean we can't change the policies, but I believe that that's not within our purview as it sits right now.
Vice Chair Riley.
There are about three things I want to follow up on. First of all, I think when you talk about whether we're legally able to do that or not, we make the laws, and so we can actually do that, I believe. And Phil, maybe the most experienced member here, is nodding his head. And so I believe that's the case.
We just got to get 31 guys to agree with
that. That's right. That's right. And I want to follow up on the pesticide question, if I might. When you're in your training of the pesticide testing, do you only teach to the test, or do you actually have some hands-on training courses? What's the situation there,
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley? We teach material around the test. We don't actually teach to the tests. The tests are not available so that we actually can just go in and by rote memory go down the list and say, okay, this is what's going to be on the test. And we have a number of courses where they actually have problems that they have to work on. Part of the test, for example, is label interpretation, label comprehension. And so they'll have to go through some series of examples on that. There are math questions, calculation, calibration of a sprayer, for example, and they will go through some examples of that. We actually have one recertification course at Chemeketa we call sprayer calibration, where they actually bring in some different kinds of sprayers and learn how to calibrate those. So it is a mixture of hand-on and classroom.
May I help?
Yes,
please. Blue Mountain Community College also offers this type of training, and we have a pest management course. It's a four-credit course, 4 hours
of lecture per week for 10 weeks, so that would be a 40 hours of lecture, along with one credit of cooperative work experience, and that one credit of cooperative work experience is actually hands-on, calibrating the sprayers, working with the sprayers, reading labels, and actually applying chemicals on the 100-acre farm, 40 hours of work actually hands-on there. So our method of delivery is an 80-hour method of delivery, and it does not teach directly to the test. It teaches what you need to be able to pass the test, but then it's up to the student to be able to take that information and take the test and find out whether they pass or not. So that's the way we deliver it.
Quick follow-up, if I may.
Please.
And so is part of that that coursework the laws around pesticides?
Yes, very specifically. In fact, for some tests, you have to pass what's called a law and safety test before you pass the individual test. And we have an actual training course. It's an 8-hour, 1-day course that specifically all they go through is laws.
Thank you very much.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One comment on the comment, and then I'll ask make my comments slash question. Be careful what you ask for. You might get it, but that may be all the money you get in a bad year. So be careful about that. One of the concerns that we constantly have here is whether we should designate funds and thereby establish the upper limit as well as the lower limit, or whether we ought to simply make a general allocation in the hope that the administrators who are running the overall programs will wisely allocate their funds among the programs they have to deal with, and that's a conundrum we deal with all the time here. Then a specific comment I wanted to make that I raised my hand for, if I may, I'm again noticing the theme that we've been dealing with in this committee from the very beginning, and this may very well have been the chair's intent, but I see a couple of themes that are coming through from what you're talking about that deals with professional and technical education in general, not only in agriculture but also in the places where the only thing remotely agricultural is what's in the lunchbox. Those are things like there's a mix between classroom training and didactic education on the one side and practical application out in the field kind of training on the other, with supervision so that you can actually correct errors as they occur rather than getting them embedded in people's brains for the long haul. The other thing I've noticed is that you, along with the plumbers and pipe fitters and the electricians and on and on and on, emphasize math skills. And I think that's a message we really need to make sure we get down to the high school and middle school level in a practical way so that you may perhaps be of help to us as we think about how we can get those programs to bring their math education into the real world so that students get the point of why we do it. Anyway, that's my comment. I don't know if you have a response to any of that or not, and if you do, I'd appreciate hearing it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, our coursework is very practical, hands-on. It's that way as it's taught at the facility in viticulture, for example. And then those students also have a 12-credit-hour cooperative work experience requirement, where they're placed out in industry, either on a vineyard or a winery, so they have that additional work experience that they are able to put with that. It's been our experience that this kind of training is what will make these students who are going to be the workforce successful in the workplace, and we want them to be successful in the workplace.
Representative Dahlem.
Thank you, Chair Witt, and I really have two questions. I had an excellent opportunity to talk to two people here that know areas that I want the points made, so allow me a little freedom, if you will. On the pesticides, when we talk about practical application, at the end of the day, our student has gone out with a 25-gallon tank, water pesticide mix, and when he goes a quarter of a mile with 14 feet of spray nozzle behind him, he'd better have run out of the right number of gallons of liquid. And if you don't, then he has to go back and figure out, is the nozzle wore out? Is the applicator wider than 14 feet? Did I not go a quarter of a mile? And my point is that when a student leaves your program, they know exactly, to the ounce, how much pesticide they're putting on the ground. And the point that I want to make is, if any one of us left this room and went to any of the garden stores, we can buy all the pesticide we want and drop it on the front yard, and the largest test we have is if we got the money to buy the pesticide. Mm-hmm. And so what I want to show is the value of the program, the monitoring of the program, the specific knowledge that these people have to have, and if they misapply, they can lose their license. So the program is not only hardy and sound, but it's the consequences of not paying attention are very severe. The other area that I want to ask Preston about, and this intrigues me, that in this building we're examining Measure 37 claims, and I keep returning to a small 0.5% of the water out of the Columbia would increase our farmland. And by the way, the farmland in your area is absolutely gorgeous. Is that a fair definition?
I would agree with that. Thank you.
Yes. Some of the richest in the world?
Possibly.
Possibly. Yeah, I'll say it is, because I live there too. But if we were to get water out of the Columbia, we could increase the farmland available for valuable crops by about 3 times what we have in Measure 730 claims, tied up in Measure 37 claims right today. Is that pretty true? Pretty close?
I think that's probably quite accurate, actually. And Mark Twain said that whiskey's for drinking and water's for fighting over. And we're really seeing that to be very, very true, that if we can allocate water as a resource, and that's not just true in Oregon, it's true worldwide. If we could allocate water for the production of food, we'd be a whole lot better off. Totally, totally agree. In response to your pesticide question, you said we need to know, we have to have the exact number of ounces. Today, when we're applying agricultural pesticides, at sometimes at rates of 1/3 of an ounce to 1/6 of an ounce per acre. An acre is approximately the size of a football field. We're supposed to put a 1/6 of an ounce on that acre. Take a 12-ounce pop can or a coffee container, 12 ounces of coffee at 1/6 of an ounce to the acre. That's 72 football fields that we're going to spread that over, and we need to do that accurately. I think we need to know what we're doing, and that's what we're training agriculturalists to do.
And you do it accurately, I might add.
Thank you.
Representative Gerard.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I'm just kind of following up on the questions before and following up what Representative Barnhart was saying. If we could, as a committee perhaps, send a recommendation to the Chancellor that vocational training, such as what you are recommending, that would seem to me to be maybe the best that we could do in this committee. Do you understand what I'm saying? And does that sound like something, maybe something that we could do for you outside of the funding issue?
Mr. Chair and Representative Gerard, excuse me. Get my mouth to speak correctly.
That's all right. I answer to a lot of different names with this spelling.
I think if you were to send a recommendation to the Chancellor of Higher Education that professional technical, specifically agricultural education in Oregon, be supported because it's important and because it is a large portion of our future in Oregon, that's a strong recommendation that be continued, and that they continue that in whatever way that they see fit, that certainly would be wonderful. And just back to Representative Barnhart's comment, be careful what you ask for, and I certainly agree with that statement. But the idea is, if you support agricultural education in Oregon and give a strong recommendation that it continue in Oregon and that it be adequately funded, however that happens, I believe the three of us at this table and those that we represent would be very pleased.
Good. Very much.
Mr. Chair, may I follow up?
Yes, please.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, one of the areas that could use more funding are the training ideas are identified in this report, we've not had the resources to follow up in all the training that is needed for some of our workforce in this area. Another idea to throw out, and this is coming from me personally, not from Chemeketa today, is that I think you need to think about the concepts of centers of excellence. And we have a vineyard management winemaking program and Northwest Viticulture Center here that's unique in the state. We have other areas of the state who have significant grape growing and winemaking. And I would like to see an initiative put forward whereby we could have some discussions about how Chemeketa might interact with those other areas and those other community colleges in those areas. And Representative Dahlem, I have had one very brief conversation with Suzanne Bird at Chelmie Gorge Community College along this line, but how we might cooperate together to where we might deliver that education more widely, but not have to build facilities at each of these community colleges, because the infrastructure is relatively expensive to maintain.
Certainly. Additional questions? I had something Preston, that came to mind when you were talking, and I guess I'd just kind of throw my question open to all three of you. But Preston, when you mentioned that your family farm had been in the family for, I think, a century and a half or something approximating that, and you stressed the importance of continuation, not only in terms of the family that runs the farm, but I think agriculture in general. One of the things that we've heard here, last time we had a number of folks in from agriculture, and we heard a little bit about the problems that our state's facing, agriculture being the second largest industry in our state, yet we are in the process of losing some of the infrastructure that makes it possible for agriculture to do the job that needs to be done. And I realize that my question may be putting you on the spot. So if you think about it and you want to add something later on, please do. But what kind of steps do we need to be taking as a state, and what kind of recommendations ought our committee to be thinking about in terms of what types of infrastructure are critical to assist agriculture in being the very best that it can be? I'm sorry for
Mr. Chair and members of the committee. That's a large question.
I understand.
Let me attempt at least to answer it in a small way. Infrastructure today has to be framed in many different directions. One of those directions happens to be information, because in today's age, agriculture as well as other industries have to have information availability. It has to almost be instantaneous. Certainly having high-speed internet access, T1 lines, those types of things are very critical to the agricultural community, and sometimes rural areas don't have availability of those. So that would be one, certainly information. Secondly, if we look at what's happening in the grain markets today, if you look at what's happened to the price of corn and the price of wheat and other grains, recently the price has increased to a profitable level for production for agriculturalists. And the reason that it's increased to that level is because someone else has demanded that grain rather than livestock producers or the human consumption. It's been the ethanol and biodiesel area who now have said, we want to take some of that so that people can drive their automobiles. And this is good news for agriculture. But as a part of that, one of the infrastructures that we're going to need is either additional roads with which to transport that commodity to the biodiesel producing area, railways, and or continued use of the best resource for transportation that we have in Oregon,
yeah.
And that be the Columbia River.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be, that's a brief response, but at least those are the infrastructures that I see. And certainly I see it in the summer. I work as an elevator manager for the Confederated Tribes of Umatilla Indian Reservation at Mission. And when they put that elevator in the late 70s, early 80s, it was a state-of-the-art facility. It had unit trains where we would ship 25 train cars at once. And that was wonderful in the late 70s and early 80s. Today, a unit train is in excess of 100 cars. And that facility now is unfortunately a little bit outdated. Back to your infrastructure question.
Representative Holmes.
I want to pursue Chair Witt's question and play the broken record I keep playing. If we were to increase agricultural land availability, which we have a lot of in the Columbia River, how much biofuel could we produce with 3% more, or one half of 1% more water out of the Columbia? Phenomenal.
I don't have the figures, but a lot is probably an understatement. I mean, an incredible amount, absolutely incredible amount. And if you look at news reports, City of Portland thinks that what we're doing in Umatilla County with biodiesel production and ethanol production is a good thing because they want to try to capture some of that production. So we're pretty excited about some of the things that biodiesel does, and I'm sure my colleagues are as well, because what's good for one aspect of agriculture is good for the rest of agriculture. Thank you for your tremendous support for that direction.
Representative Ryan.
I happen to live out in a district that has Staten, and Staten draws its water out of the Santiam River, as does the City of Salem, as does the Irrigation District. If they all drew the amount of water that they have water rights for, we wouldn't meet minimum fish flows. Water policy is something that's pretty important to me. You see that as part of your infrastructure that's needed down the road, not just on the Columbia, but just an overall state water policy would seem to me something that would be in order. Would you concur with that?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm not sure whether this is infrastructure or not, but certainly having a trained workforce that we've been talking about all morning is very crucial to keeping agriculture going. The other one that we deal with in our agribusiness management program continuously is the succession of families on farms. I think, the average age of the farmer today in Oregon is 55 or on up maybe a little bit, and transferring those farms from generation to generation is becoming a big obstacle and something that needs to be addressed. And certainly education needs to go around that to plan that ahead of time.
Our last committee meeting, we heard a good bit about the importance of transferring farms generation to generation, and part of that discussion, I think, was our state's or estate tax policies. Gentlemen, you might be interested to know that the community colleges will be assisting our committee in writing up our informational report and recommendations. So the community colleges have been exceedingly helpful to us throughout our committee's work. Thank you very, very much for coming today and your very excellent testimony. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Elizabeth, by process of elimination, did you want to say anything today? Okay. Is there anyone else from the public that would wish to say anything today? Anything here from our committee members? Not seeing anything. Ellen, could you give us a preview of what we're going to be doing here on Wednesday?
On Wednesday, February 14th, the committee will be hearing House Bill, its first public hearing on House Bill 2206, which establishes the Skill Up Oregon Fund. It continuously appropriates monies in the fund to the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, and it establishes a program to award grants to local and regional workforce investment boards to provide workforce training to individuals to become employed in high-demand occupations.
And with that, seeing nothing more to come before our committee today, we stand adjourned until Wednesday. Thank you all very, very much.